Good morning. Get this presentation up and away we'll go. Well, I'm sure not everybody's up yet this morning. I just thought it would be appropriate if all of the scientists, faculty members, extension specialists, who either have retired or are about to retire from our industry, if you would stand up so that we can say thank you for a lifetime of great work. I don't know if Daryl Strobing and others are here, but if you're here and you're leaving our fold, we'd like to acknowledge you. I've got to tell you, it is so awesome to be at the BIF meetings. In the midst of all the chaos of this industry, this is the one place that you can come and know that one thing is going to drive the whole proceedings, and that's the best interests of the American cattle industry. I think BIF is the best example of a federation that works. And my hat is off to all of you who have contributed to the spirit that makes this organization and this event work. Let's thank the folks from Missouri for a great event. And again, thank you so much for the hard work that Bob and Ben and others have put in. This is a great title because it allows me to say about anything. If you read the proceedings, you will notice that there will be some semblance of correlation between the proceedings and the presentation, but not a lot. I was just pleased that I actually got the proceedings in on time. A lot has happened since then. I think I got invited to do this based on a presentation I gave at the Western Section meetings for Animal Science a year ago. My goal this morning is to do two things, to give you a 10,000-foot view of what I think is going on in the world around our industry, and maybe most importantly, to try to give you a level of perception and thought and perspective about why you need to behave differently in what you do for a living. So there are two quotes that I want to lead with. These are fundamental to what I have to say today. Aldous Huxley said, "Facts do not cease to exist because they are ignored." Any of you who were trained by Jim Brinks or others in animal breeding know that you can massage the data set to get the answer you want, but it may in fact not have been the right answer. And Ayn Rand said, "You can avoid reality, but you cannot avoid the consequences of avoiding reality." And reality is staring us square in the face today. I actually have an affinity for this approach. See no evil, hear no evil, say no evil. I'd like to bury my head in the sand lots of days, but it is not an option if you want to build a future for this business. I'm going to talk about a whole number of things, and some of these things may in fact sound contradictory, and if you know me, you will not be surprised by that, because there is so much chaos in the world today that I think we're trying to make sense of. And some of the answers that we want yield consequences in other areas that actually are not in our best interests, and vice versa. This big interrelated system we work in. So let's talk about productivity first. What have been our goals? I think we heard this a lot yesterday, to increase the volume of meat production, not only domestically but worldwide, and we have been successful at that, to improve productivity per animal. And the reality is we have been magnificently successful. Not only in the cattle industry, but the dairy industry, the swine industry, the poultry industry. Unbelievable productivity on a per animal basis. And we have, I believe, by virtue of a lot of the work done by this organization and its members, work to improve the quality and value of beef. And we've been successful at that. Genetics gets a big piece of the credit for this trend line. Certainly better management, the integration of nutrition and health and reproduction, genetic information. We have been unbelievably successful at making more beef per animal. But there has been a consequence to that productivity. And I think it's one we have to pause and think about. And I don't know what the best answer is, but I think it's worth pausing to think about a couple of the questions. Relative to per animal productivity as a focus, is our ladder on the right or the wrong wall with that particular focus? Have we climbed one rung too high? And where should we focus in the future? Industry concentration. Our unbelievable success at productivity has allowed us, and our unparalleled focus on improving cost of production has in fact contributed to concentration in our industry. Take a look at food retailing. Walmart, which if I'd given this talk 10 years ago would not have been on this screen, today holds 29% of the food retail dollar sales in the United States, with international operations all over the world. The next four contribute an additional 23% of sales. The next five, 17.6%. The top 10 retailers, 70% of the food sales at retail in the United States of America. The top five have a little more than half of that. When concentration at retail occurs, it will force concentration in the rest of the industry. Now, I think these three little lines of information are worth a conference in and of themselves. I think they are a place where there's a lot of opportunity for discussion and thought and consideration of the future. Cow-calf herds with fewer than 50 head account for 80% of the enterprises, but only 28% of the cows. Cow-calf herds with more than 100 head account for 11% of the total enterprises, but nearly 50% of the cow herd. And it puts us in a unique position, whether we're a member policy organization and whether we are a member genetics organization, or whether we are a land-grant university system, or whether we are a for-profit technology company. Where do we focus? In a world with shrinking resources, whose needs do we meet? And this is a pivotal question. I do not have an answer. But those two lines of information, I think, force us to start to begin to make strategic decisions. And that last line is also important. Less than 15% of cow-calf enterprises depend on cattle as their primary income source. This is neither good nor bad, but it does lead the challenges of how to move an industry in a direction. And we must consider those three things in all that we do. I think we have some things to worry about in our business. This is my gravest concern. Far more than anything else I'm going to talk about today, I'm worried that since 1987, nearly a quarter of a million producers have exited the cattle business. 250,000 fewer enterprises which means 250,000 fewer engines of local economies, which means 250,000 fewer folks with great historic intelligence about the land that they managed. And the organization I work for depends on a healthy industry. All of you who sell genetics know that you depend on a healthy industry, because if the name of the game is to sell more bulls, we need more customers, or at least customers with more cows. Inventory in the cow herd today is the lowest since World War II. I can remember Bob Taylor, my mentor, and we talked, and he said, the good news, we will never go below a million producers. We have gone below a million producers. We're at nearly 750,000. I was quite certain we would never go below 35 million cows. We are below 35 million cows. And what concerns me the most is that from 1999 to 2008, if you look at the Livestock Market Information Center's data, if you look at Cattle Factor's data, if you look at almost anybody's data, that was a relatively profitable time for our industry. And people still left. Why? No doubt, drought played a role. We know that significant portion of this nation in the last 15 years has experienced drought. No doubt a factor. We know that input costs have been problematic, and that we have seen so much volatility in input costs that it has been difficult to manage cost of production. We know that the drive for recreational land, followed by a national ethanol policy, took land values to places none of us would have imagined. We know that rural economies are at a crossroads. We know rural communities all over this nation trying to make choices about where to go next. And that indecision and that lack of economic power has created some challenge. Age of our producers. The media, and maybe more importantly than the media, the inability of the American consumer and citizen to think about these issues has us in a bind. We have never dealt with a more inexperienced, a more uninformed electorate or set of elected officials in the history of this nation when it comes to agriculture. And finally, the regulatory environment. Our family owns a ranch in western Colorado. Most of our valuable time is eaten up by issues around regulation. The federal level, the state level, the local level. How many of you in the production sector spend more time today dealing with government agencies than you did 20 years ago? A lot of hands go up. The regulatory burden. So all these taken in concert, I got to tell you, I think what happened is a lot of producers, a lot of those 250,000 said, you know what, the aggravation of all of this is greater than the reward. And we're going to cash the land because we can see those land values going up. And we had folks that said, you know, I always wanted a career in team roping. Now's my chance. And we've all had that thought at one time or another. Consumers. Some of the very best work that gets done at NCBA is in the work of our efforts to understand, quantify, and predict consumer behavior. I am fascinated by this whole area of work. It is a challenge, and it is amazing to operate in this environment where when a consumer walks into their grocery store 24/7, this is the view they get up on the screen. We have to ask ourselves the question, what is it that these folks want? And I think there are three groups of people that we have to do a better job of understanding. We have to understand the baby boomers. Why do we need to understand those folks? Because they have the money. And they're about to make a swap in wealth equivalent to the Louisiana Purchase. We have to understand the millennials. How many of you with teenagers? I have three. You will notice I have more gray hair than I've ever had, and it's not NCBA that did that. It's the millennials who want instant communication, instant gratification, instant answers, and less accountability in many ways. And then the final group, those who actually make most of the decisions in the marketplace, women who now outnumber men in the employment workforce, they make the choices because they happen to control the money. So those three groups are pretty important to us. And the woman consumer that we're trying to deal with is not the female consumer of 20 or 30 or 40 years ago. She is this well-educated, highly trained, very aware, highly networked professional. And we need to figure out how to communicate with her better. What's top of mind today for consumers? This is the Pew Research Center. This is their own data. Top three things that are top of mind for consumers today are the economy, jobs, and terrorism. The next tier, Social Security, education, Medicare, and reducing the deficit. Very low down, global warming. I only point this out to say that the economy is the trump card. Always has been, always will be. The economy is the trump card. My friend Randy Block at Cattle Facts puts it even better. He says, the market has a paddle big enough for everybody's behind. Amen, brother. And we've all had our paddling in the last few years. But if we think more globally, if we think about consumers all across the world, I would venture to say that first and third world consumers ask different questions. I think third world consumers ask the questions is how much protein, how many calories, and will I be able to access food tomorrow? Whereas today, first world consumers get to ask questions like price, how did you handle it, were antibiotics involved, is it natural, is it local, is the product convenient? We deal with two very different spectrums in that realm. The United Nations Food and Agricultural Organization tells us that in the next 50 years we must feed the equivalent of two more Chinas. That is both daunting and exciting. Two more Chinas. That is a Herculean task. I wonder what Borlaug would tell us, this man whose life saved so many others. Towards the end of his life, 2000, he gave a speech about the freedom of choice and the law of unintended consequences. And he said this, the world has the technology to feed on a sustainable basis 10 billion people. The pertinent question today is whether farmers and ranchers will be permitted to use the technologies that will allow that to happen. There's a lot of discussion today around modern production methods. And I think we have to be careful in how we approach this. My basic take is that we don't owe it to anyone to defend any particular technology or any particular product. What we do owe our industry and our consumers is the opportunity to have freedom of choice, to be able to choose as an individual, independent business owner, that production system which makes the most sense in the environment in which you live. And the defense of choice is really the battle. I am for conventional beef production. I am for organic beef production. I am for natural beef production. I am for producers having the ability to find market niches and fill them with a product that people want. That's the free market. And I'm for consumers having the opportunity to choose what fits them best. But choice. That's the power of liberty. Ketchum did a great study that looked at sort of the global marketplace, and they asked consumers in the United States, the United Kingdom, Germany, Argentina, and China a lot of questions about what drove their choices, what drove their attitudes and their appetites. And here's what they found when you pool all that data: taste, quality, and price. Now, if you've ever heard Gary Smith talk, and if you heard him 20 years ago, Gary Smith said what? Taste, quality, price. That bar has not moved. So that's where we have to focus. Ketchum, they went on and asked, if you were CEO of a global food company, what would be your goals? And here's what consumers, we pool that data from all across the planet, here's what they said. 65% said improve human nutrition. And I think as we're learning, that may be the true promise of the new genetic technologies, is the ability to maybe really create these fundamentally unique nutritional products that meet unique health needs of unique populations of people. 64% said improve food safety. And half said make sure you make foods that taste great. So consumer focus is pretty clear in this big aggregate. But the mindset is an important one, because it's not only the mindset of consumers but the emerging mindset of their children. What do we know today? We know that today about 17% of consumers across all the geographic or all the demographic perspective, about 17% want to know more about food production practices and processes. 7% actually express some concern about what we're doing. 5% really want a lifestyle food, vegan, free-range, certified humane, and 3% regularly buy organic foods. And it's important to note that in today's economy, only about 25% of consumers in the United States can afford those products. But there is change coming if we start to look at the millennials. Private foundations, environmental and public health groups, chefs, media, and the marketplace call for change in the name of healthier consumers. healthier farm animals, and a healthier planet. And that call is a concept that the elites in this nation have embraced. The elites who are critical of the agricultural system, the elites who make the decisions in media, and the elites who make the decision in government. California Institute of Food and Agricultural Resources went on to say that you've got to do these four things if you want to meet this emerging generational need. Transparency, you have to be authentic. Your product has to be healthful, but so must be your process. And that instant gratification realm has produced an entire generation of consumers who want more than calories and nutrition. They want an experience with the foods that they consume, which does open the door for us to create a relationship with them. There's more opportunity in this than dread, in my opinion. Now, we do a lot of consumer focus groups, and one of the things that John Lundeen and his team has uncovered in the last 3 or 4 months is that when we ask consumers who have told us that they've limited beef consumption in the last 6 months, and then they go in and they ask them why, 49% said price, and it's because the economy's pinching their family really hard. But 40% of those who limited their consumption, and interestingly enough, that's not a huge number. It's about a quarter of consumers said, this factory farming thing is in the back of our head, and we keep hearing about these factory farms and beef production. So that tells me it's in their heads. Food Foresight 2009 said, look, in addition to all that, this emerging consumer coming out of these economic tough times is going to be more mindful about desires versus necessities. And all of you who are parents have had the want and need conversation with children and tried hard to explain to them that wants and needs are not always the same. I wish some of you would go ahead and write your congressman if you've been successful. Because there's a lot of gray teenagers there who need some advice. The emerging consumer will be more vigilant about spending. Our savings pattern as American consumers, it's unbelievable. 5 years ago, it was a free-for-all. Spend, baby, spend. And today, it's save, baby, save. And we're seeing consumers start to make trade-offs. The interesting thing, in the last year and a half, our data says consumers did not trade out of the beef category, by and large, but they did trade down. If they were a whole muscle user, they traded to a cheaper whole muscle. If they were a cheap whole muscle user, they traded to ground beef. And if they were a ground beef user already, they looked for the cheapest ground beef, and they maybe limited the total amount of ground beef they purchased, but they aren't leaving the category. People want this product. So where does that leave us? And we have this vortex. And maybe it's partly the job I work in, but I've got to tell you, I feel a lot like I'm in the middle of one of those great episodes of The Most Dangerous Catch, when you're trying to pull up crab pots and the ocean is working against you, and it's just chaotic and you're tired, and I think all of us feel this. The tech phobia of our consumers. It still blows my mind. I'm afraid of production technologies as they operate 19 different electronic devices simultaneously. That sort of blows my mind. Consumer confusion. Consumers have never been more confused than they are today. The activist environment, and let's be honest. Today, the activists see their opportunity and they are whipping and spurring, riding for Dodge because they see their opportunity. Market chaos. If you like volatility, you have loved this marketplace. In my opinion, some poor ag policy choices, regulation, and the reality is our most dangerous foe is ourselves. Industry infighting scares me more than anything else that we do. So I want to talk about the regulatory environment a little bit. I'm going to try to not spend tons of time here, but it's something that whether we like it or not, remember again back to those first couple of quotes, ignoring the facts does not make them go away. These are issues that are in front of us that we must deal with and work through, and we must understand there are consequences to the choices that are going to be made by this Congress and this administration, not only now, but in the future. We have got to come to grips with this. Production technologies, food safety, animal well-being, environment, and free market, those are all places that intersect in this realm of what choices will we have in the future. Nothing is more contentious in the extremes than the animal well-being discussion and debate because the extremes are so extreme. There is animal abuse in this country. Fortunately, most of it doesn't happen with livestock. But there is animal abuse, and there is abuse in our industry. It's limited, in my opinion. But we must drive it out of our business because it is a bad weed in our field of progress. On the other hand, are the animal liberationists, those who would go so far as to say that animals ought to be able to sue their owners in courts of law. And the head of regulatory affairs in the White House, a guy by the name of Cass Sunstein, a law professor from the University of Chicago, has in fact advocated for that. But those are extremes, aren't they? It leaves those of us who care for God's creatures in the middle in this world of animal use, with some connection potentially to those traditional, very well thought out folks who are in that animal protection realm who protect animals and children because they believe there's a value there. That middle ground is where we are. And we must defend the middle ground against both extremes. We have to defend the middle ground. Beef quality assurance, stockmanship and stewardship, all the great programs that your extension services across this nation bring forth to help us do better in this middle ground is so critical. And this correct handling of cattle, it was, and I didn't know it at the time, but I now recognize how privileged I was to have an office right next to Temple Grandin for 17 years of my life. This remarkable, extraordinary human being who opened the door for the right discussions. But it wasn't just Temple. It was Bud Williams and Tom Nofsinger. It's Kurt Pate, Ron Gill down in Texas, and so many folks who help us think this through. But all they're doing is reminding us what we always knew. My father-in-law handed me a book over Christmas. He said, "You got to read this. This is a story about an old cowboy and his life and the Big Bend country of Texas." And this is what he said as those first silent movies were coming out, the first cowboy movies, and this old rancher said, "You know, a lot of those Western plays, movies, are unreal. They're running their horses all the time here and yonder. The old cowhand didn't do that unless it was necessary to run a cow or after some animal. He didn't just race his horse everywhere he could go. A lot of them drive their cattle too fast on the screen. They're trotting them or running them as fast as they can go. That's not the way we handled cattle or the way they are handled today on the ranches. They're handled quiet. Just being reminded of where we are today is to remember where we have been. The answers are there. I'm really intrigued with this whole realm of stockmanship because I think, and those of you who know me know that I'm still kind of sad over the fact we changed departments of animal husbandry to animal science. I wish they were departments of animal husbandry and science. Because there's an opportunity here, this marriage of art and science and professional stockmanship, to move ourselves into the realm of being craftsmen instead of technicians, and means that we have to examine our attitude, our processes, our facilities. We have to train people, our families, our employees, our day help. We have to communicate expectations, measure performance, and seek improvement. Who benefits? This is the win-win-win-win-win deal in our business. You benefit, your people benefit, your cattle benefit, your customers benefit, and your consumer benefits when we put the principles of stockmanship to work in our industry. There's a lot of work that talks about what motivates human beings, and mastery is at the very top of the list, far beyond money. Stockmanship gives us the opportunity for mastery, to become the master stockman. I am going to blatantly advertise for a moment. My apologies. Stockmanship and Stewardship Tour is a program that can be brought to your community. Kurt Pate and Ron Gill, two great clinicians. Got them operating independently now so we can get more events for our money. But we are willing to cost share any event you want to have. The way you schedule one of those events is to go to www.bqa.org, click on the Stockmanship and Stewardship. The information will be there. You can email either me or Grace, and we will help you set up that program to bring that message not only to producers, but also to consumers. I'm very excited about the fact that at the California State Fair, Kurt Pate we'll have three or four clinics in front of a vast number of California consumers so that we can help them understand what you do on the land. I'm going to take a very quick second and talk about the free market. Many times government well-intendedly attempts to right wrongs or deal with perceived wrongs. I would strongly encourage you to study very carefully the GPSA ruling that has been proposed. It is critical for you to understand it. It does not matter to me whether you agree with me or not, but I strongly encourage you seek legal counsel on this issue because it does not just affect packers. Here's why I believe that. GPSA will require that all marketing contracts be posted for public review. All marketing contracts will be posted for public review. And GPSA will review them as to whether or not they are fair. This takes away from the basic American premise of a willing buyer and a willing seller working under the concept of choice. This organization has worked extremely hard to differentiate value in cattle, to add value, to make cattle better. This ruling potentially sends this industry 20 years back to a 100% cash basis sale with no ability to differentiate in the marketplace. Persons wanting to file a lawsuit under this ruling no longer have to show harm. This is a lawyer's dream. It means that anybody can sue anybody over anything they want relative to a marketing contract. So far as I'm almost certain that if I sell a set of calves from our ranch on Superior, and my 5.5 weight calves bring this price, but my neighbor's 550-pound calves bring this price, he can bring suit against my contract to have featured those cattle on Superior. We have to understand this. GPSA considers marketing arrangements based on volume or premiums for quality as potentially showing undue preference. This is another hit to producers' ability to enter into a marketing arrangement. Differentiation between source and age, valued here, non-source and age here, this ruling says that may be unfair preference. We need to understand this at more than its face value. As an industry, we have to dig deeper, and we have got to learn, all of us, to set our emotion aside and let our reason dictate. Just like BIF, that's what I love so much about this, and I appreciate, you cannot imagine. Those of you in the academic community, be careful what you wish for. Because there is reason in this place. We must cling to it. The environment, I'm going to hit these very quickly. The Clean Water Act, which if it is in fact eventually finds its way through the morass of our government system to redefine the waters of the United States as any standing pool of water on the 50 states, it means that every drop of water on every ranch and every farm is subject to federal regulation. Not sure that's what Jefferson had in mind. Dust and particulate concentrations resulting from normal farming and ranching operations, if in fact the Clean Air legislation continues to move forward, your movement down a country road that stirs up a cloud of dust may well in fact put you in violation of federal law. Ammonia and greenhouse gas, we know about that, cap and trade, lots of challenges. Production technologies. Monday, FDA provides a guidance document released relative to antimicrobials. This is what it says. Medically important antimicrobial drugs for production purposes is not in the interest of protecting and promoting public health. Medically important antimicrobials should be limited to those uses that include veterinary oversight or consultation. This is not law, but these guidance documents have the force of law under the current judiciary interpretation. What this guidance document puts at question is over-the-counter sales of the antimicrobials you have purchased and used judiciously and carefully and correctly. And it puts at question all use of these technologies in feed and water. So what do we do? I've always liked these two pictures. The dead armadillo with the yellow stripes. Probably days we all feel a little bit like that. We can take it out. Hell, it's not my job. Somebody else will tend to this. Or we can take ownership. This is a picture a friend of mine, Major Terry Sladek, who has done 3 tours in Afghanistan, 2 tours in Iraq. And he keeps going back. He's my age. Because Terry Sladek knows how to keep young Marines alive. He sent me this picture recently, and in the Ram family, he's a Ram, and we have, every week since he's been on any of these, we send from our big extended family, we send stuff to wherever Terry and his people are at. And he sends us these updates, and he sent me this picture, and He said, this young Marine, in the middle of this outpost, in the middle of godforsaken Afghanistan, is polishing the tip of the company standard minutes before a memorial service for two of his fallen comrades. And Terry said, I want you to understand this is not required of him. This is not his job. No one told him to go polish the tip. But that young Marine standing in that place with our interests at heart said, I'm a Marine. We do it right. And he polished the tip, even though nobody told him. I think that's the best of us. I think that's who we are. I think that's our job. Is to grab that standard, put it in our laps, and polish it. That young Marine in this picture has driven my thinking for 3 months. I think every time it gets hard, I think about him. So what do we do? I think it's time for us as an industry to assess where we're at. And you know what? Not in some great big conference, but in family rooms and living rooms all across this country, the best decisions are going to be made by families that always have been. Sit down as a family and ask, what's our vision? What are our prevailing attitudes? What are our core values? Why are we here? What legacy do we want to create and leave? Are we going to be craftsmen or technicians? Then we have to evaluate. This is hard. I have, in our family business, Laura and I have my two brothers, and we have diverse viewpoints of the world. I've got a brother who's a consultant in Boston, and I've got a brother who's a banker. I would never have a banker for a partner. We have to do a lot of evaluation to make our deal work. We have to take a hard look. Processes, protocols, the things that affect our profitability, the well-being of our people and our livestock and the health of our resources. And then we have to make thoughtful, intentional decisions in line with our core values that demonstrate the pride of our ownership. Because that, in the end of the day, that pride of ownership that has so characterized the beef cattle business since the first cattle came to this continent. Pride of ownership. It will take commitment. I think these are the times that try men's souls. Commitment's there. We know we have the example. They lie in our parents and grandparents and great-grandparents and great-great-grandparents. And I would encourage you to get in touch with that. We have to communicate internally. We have to train our people. We have to communicate. Not our strength, but a skill we must learn. We must seek partners. I think profits and longevity for our industry are partner-dependent. No one loves John Wayne more than me. My favorite scene from Big Jake is when John Wayne comes back to town to go find his grandson, and his son walks up and he says, well, welcome home, Daddy. John Wayne climbs off that horse, and next thing you know, the son is in the water trough. John Wayne says, you can call me Jacob. You can call me Father, but don't ever call me Daddy. It's a great scene. You know what? That independence is awesome. It is an important part of our heritage, but we are dependent on one another. There are only 750,000 of us left. We better get dependent on each other. I believe the strength of federated organizations are state and local organizations. When I came to NCBA, I believed the most important thing was a strong NCBA. Today, I believe something very different. I believe the most important thing are very strong local cattlemen's organizations and very strong state affiliates. probably BIF works because there are strong academic communities and strong breed associations and strong independent business people who run these very creative, very cool businesses in the seed stock industry. We need to engage in those things. And I think we need to look for partners outside our industry, and we're going to find those partners in places we didn't expect to find them. And we're going to find them in places with organizations that we used to think were maybe not our best friend, but what we're slowly learning is the most rational environmental groups understand that large-scale farming and ranching is the key not only to feeding the planet, but protecting the ecosystem. And we got to find them, and we got to build alliances. Now, this maybe goes back to my 20 years at CSU, but it's still knowledge. It's education. Why we must continue to ask our state legislators to fund land-grant universities, and why we must ask them to continue to fund the good work of the federal research system. And we have to take some control, because only by learning can we actually lead. We need to learn the facts about our own contributions to the community, to the landscape, to animal well-being, the economy, consumers, and the food system, and then we need to tell people that story. We need to engage them. I don't know if you have read on some of the online newsletters, but my friend Steve Gable at Magnum Feed Yard invited a vegan nutritionist to their feed yard. It's a remarkable story about engagement, because he left going, wait a minute, this is not the factory farm I imagined. While I have chosen a vegan lifestyle, if I were to choose animal protein, I would choose beef because I like what these people do. We cannot be afraid any longer. It is time to get off the defense and go on the offense. We've got to engage in discussion that occurs in social and traditional media, political and regulatory arena, in classrooms, boardrooms, and family rooms, and that responsibility belongs to us. Now, in all these areas, production technologies, environment, animal well-being, food safety, free markets, etc., we have a role to play at looking at ourselves and making sure that what we do is right, that is in line with our core values. So we do have to do this process simultaneously. We have got to look in the mirror. We have to be honest with ourselves. And let me put that in context with a story. If you're a historian or a history buff at all, you know that as Hitler advanced into France and Belgium, that he drove the English and French forces in front of him and drove them to the sea. And that miracle at Dunkirk, where the British Armada rescued the remnants of the British command structure. And you know that the command structure following the defeat at Dunkirk was in fact a mess. Lots of middle-level military leaders wounded, captured, or dead. And so the command structure changed radically, and people that had not been in positions of leadership before were asked to be leaders in places that they might not know much about. And in fact, this young infantryman was sent to the artillery in a command position. And he was told, your job is to be in charge of artillery training. And so he reported to his post, and he walked up and he noticed that at each of the batteries where they were practicing, there were a group of people, and there was a guy who loaded and a guy who fired the cannon, and there was a helper, and then there was one guy who stood next to each cannon before it fired, and all he did was snap to attention right before they fired the cannon. Now, he was British, and this offended his sense of British efficiency, and he said to the non-com who was there, he said, what's that guy's job? He said, sir, I have been trained to train him to do that. And it made no sense to him, so he went up the command and he went right to the top, asking the whole way, and every juncture he was told, in the British artillery, we have a guy who snaps to attention. And finally, he said, okay, whatever. So one night he went to the pub, have a pint, sat down at the bar, and there was this older gentleman sitting there, and he got to talking to the old man and found out that he was a veteran of the Boer War in South Africa. And as they talked more, he found out he was an artilleryman, and he said, "Hallelujah." He looked at him, he said, "Sir," he said, "we've had this realignment of the command structure. And he told the story, and he showed him what he had discovered. And he finally said, he said, "There's this guy that snaps attention." He says, "What is that man supposed to do?" And the old man looked at him and he said, "It is obvious he is there to hold the horses." I think this is a parable for our industry. I have huge regard for yesterday's opening speaker. He is one of my favorite people in this business, Barry Dunn. And I would say, as having been a faculty for a long time, you develop this sort of distrust of administrators. And I would say that some of the greatest hope in the planet right now is the fact that Barry Dunn has chosen to become the dean at South Dakota State, and that my friend Ronnie Green has chosen to become the vice chancellor at the University of Nebraska. We are poorer for their choices in many ways, but our future is brighter because those kind of people have chosen that route. So I want to pay honor to Barry. He was right yesterday. And I'll finish with M. Scott Peck's quote, "The truth is that our finest moments are most likely to occur when we are feeling deeply uncomfortable, unhappy, or unfulfilled. For it is only in such moments, propelled by our discomfort, that we are likely to step out of our ruts and start searching for different ways or truer answers." And as we learned on Monday night, maybe that was Dick Quaz's magic, was the ability to force his graduate students into those uncomfortable places that led to discovery. Let us seek them as well. Thank you. Thanks. You bet.